Welcome. Welcome, everyone, to the latest of our celebration, our event celebrating the 400th anniversary of the birth of John Milton, our alumnus in Christ's. This event today is a Lady Margaret event, named after our foundress, Lady Margaret Beaufort, and we're privileged to have Geoffrey Hill here to speak. Geoffrey is an honorary fellow of Emmanuel College and one of the most important and celebrated British poets of the past half century. Indeed, A.N. Wilson has described Geoffrey as probably the best writer alive in verse or in prose. Geoffrey has published more than a dozen collections of poetry, both in his poems and in his critical writings as Style and Faith. His work addresses questions of history, memory, place, language, inspiration, and inheritance. And in his most recent collections, notably Scenes from Comus and A Treatise of Civil Power, he's in a sustained way engaged with John Milton. In his lecture today, he considers Milton from this viewpoint and reads from Milton and from his own work. So, Geoffrey, to speak on Milton as Muse.
Thank you. One necessary introductory question. I am supposed to be wired up for sound. Is it all right? Can you hear?
Yes.
Right. The terms on which I was invited to deliver this Lady Margaret lecture were generous. I was asked merely to read passages from Milton's work, which I had found to inspire my own writing, and to read passages from my own writing, which reflected or embodied that connection. However, I consider the Lady Margaret lectures to possess their own especial dignity of status, and the invitation to deliver one a particular accolade. I felt increasingly, as I looked through various texts, Milton's and my own, that I should at least offer some kind of historical contextual reasons for why I write as I do, and why Milton's writings over the past 25 years have come to hold a major place in my creative imagination, if I may be permitted to employ such a term. The result, I regret to say, is an unmanageable congestion. Either a lecture congested by too much quotation, or a reading disabled by excess of commentary. Even had I felt able to deliver a straightforward lecture, given the emphases I wish to make, there would necessarily have been omissions from my plan of reference. My chosen or given theme, Milton as Muse, has massive implications and connections. You could say that he was Muse to a huge amount of 18th century English poetry and poetry criticism. I shall be compelled to omit most of the attention due to Addison's taste-forming essays on Paradise Lost, which ran in The Spectator from January the 5th to May the 3rd, 1712. 12 essays in all, if I remember correctly, one for each book. These essays created a taste for Milton. Addison was strong on taste, and created it for the whole of the 18th century and beyond. Almost certainly at the price of cutting off Milton's recalcitrant personal public voice. His political voice, yes, but not wholly his political voice. though for want of a better word, I do Milton's public voice a disservice in so placing it. I'm perhaps shying away from the word emasculated. Having now used it, I find I'm still breathing. Addison gave Milton a wide fame. The Spectator was widely read, but at the price of emasculating his work. If public judgment had been able to make anything of Andrew Marvell's commendatory poem to the second 12-book edition of Paradise Lost of 1674, a commendation which can speak of having at first misdoubted Milton's intent as one, the world o'erwhelming to revenge his sight, the world o'erwhelming to revenge his sight, or his fears, that is Marvell's fears, on first looking at the poem, how he his way should find, or which lame face leads understanding blind. Things might have gone if people had really cottoned onto that. Things might have gone differently. Understanding blind. That wonderful phrase of Marvell's is not only like Milton. Compare the blind mouths of the intruders in Lycidas. It also leaps ahead to Wordsworth. Blind understanding is Wordsworth in both bafflement and groping intuition. Wordsworth is profoundly Miltonic. Those poets and readers brought up on the sublimities and select beauties of Addison's essays inherited a much safer kind of poet. I exempt from this caveat in part Samuel Johnson, because when Johnson says that Milton's poems are too often distinguished by repulsive harshness, the combination of words are new, but they are not pleasing. The rhymes and epithets seem to be laboriously sought and violently applied. Johnson is in a large sense correct. From time to time, great new work has something about it which is repulsive to the settled taste of the time. The Wasteland and Ulysses were repulsive. Robert Bridges found a good deal of Hopkins repellent. Wordsworth's early poems were derided and dismissed for bad taste. William Blake's finding Milton repellent is a huge qualifying factor. And these notes are all the scattier for my having to pass the matter over in a paragraph. What Blake recognized in the confrontation of himself and Milton, and it is his great gift passed on to writers such as myself, he recognized a confrontation between two massive powers or energies, Milton's and his own. I no longer see, if I ever did, the linear progress of a poem as a more or less efficient unwinding of a personal narrative along the lines of those First World War field postcards which the troops sent home. You know the sort of thing what I call linear progress. You know, I woke up, I screwed the wife, I gave the children their breakfast, I went into college, I had a nervous breakdown, I won the T.S. Eliot Prize. delete, whichever is irrelevant. My view of things is not linear in that sense. I see it as a form of agon between conflicting pulling powers, one of which is an enormous self-will to impose order on words which have, so to speak, inordinately presented themselves to the poet. One of which is a power deriving from somewhere I don't know, which decrees that the order shall not be brought to pass. One of which is a collision with the things of the world. Ralph Cudworth, if I remember rightly, an Emmanuel man, Ralph Cudworth in 1647 called these powers the strong magic of nature, which pulls and draws everything continually to that place which is suitable to it, and to which it doth belong. So all these heavy bodies press downwards towards the center of our earth, being drawn in by it. Then there's a colon. And he continues, in like manner, hell, wheresoever it is, will by strong sympathy pull in all sin and magnetically draw it to itself. Every true poet, I believe, must know some aspect of this magnetic downward drawing power, which is simultaneously egocentrism and semantics. What the poet is drawing to herself, I'm not indicating any particular person, I am just being gender sensitive. What she is drawing to herself, the poet, is what at the same time she is being drawn into. The business of the world, as the 17th century divines used to say, which at times presents itself in drastic forms. As we all recognize today the power of plutocratic anarchy, and at other times keeps itself better hidden, as I think many forces were kept hidden in the England of the 19, Britain of the 1950s, in which I grew up. The problem I've now brought upon myself is this, that I am neither properly in or properly outside the matter I engage with. It might have been easier 30 or so years ago when I had not dug myself so deeply into a sense of my own recalcitrance and defeat. But I think I have always felt myself to be a kind of blind mouths, blind understanding poet, working in a climate where self-deprecation and accessibility are the terms for acceptance. In the past 3 years, I have brought out 2 collections bearing Miltonic titles as the Master of Christ's remarked in the introduction. Scenes from Comus, 2005, A Treatise of Civil Power, 2007. And in writing them, I felt myself attuned to some particular aspects of Milton's creative energies. And I would say that almost more than anything in Milton's work, it is the contentious sonnets that mean most to me. And I shall read 4 of the contentious. They're not all entirely political. They are broadly political. So I choose this more neutral term, contentious. On the detraction which followed upon my writing certain treatises. I did but prompt the age to quit their clogs by the known rules of ancient liberty, when straight a barbarous noise environs me of owls and cuckoos, asses, apes and dogs, as when those hinds that were transformed to frogs railed at Latona's twin-born progeny, which after held the sun and moon in fee. But this is got by casting pearl to hogs that bawl for freedom in their senseless mood and still revolt when truth would set them free. License they mean when they cry liberty. For who loves that must first be wise and good. But from that mark how far they rove we see. For all this waste of wealth and loss of blood. That particular polemic distinction between license and liberty was a very common distinction made in the polemical writings of Milton's period. What he does, of course, in writing about it in this compact sonnet is to ensure that the force of the irony is, as it were, held within the constraints of the line. And paradoxically or oxymoronically, the very fact that it is held within the restraints of the line draws more attention to its general applicability. Let's try another of these contentious sonnets. This is a poem written concerning the reaction to his pamphlet on divorce, Tetrachordon. A book was writ of late called Tetrachordon, and woven close both matter, form, and style. The subject knew. It walked the town a while, numbering good intellects, now seldom pored on. Cries the stall reader, bless us, what a word on a title page is this. and some in file stand spelling false, while one might walk to mile end green. Why is it harder, sirs, than Gordon, Colquitto, or MacDonald, or Galasp? Those rugged names to our like mouths grow sleek, that would have made Quintilian stare and gasp. Thy age like ours, O soul of Sir John Cheke, hated not learning worse than toad or asp, when thou taught'st Cambridge and King Edward Greek. To the Lord General Cromwell, May 1652, on the proposals of certain ministers at the Committee for Propagation of the Gospel. Cromwell, our chief of men, who through a cloud not of war only, but detractions rude, guided by faith and matchless fortitude to peace and truth, thy glorious way hast ploughed. And on the neck of crowned fortune proud hast reared God's trophies and his work pursued. While Darwin's stream with blood of Scots imbrued and Dunbar field resounds thy praises loud, and Worcester's laureate wreath. Yet much remains to conquer still. Peace hath her victories no less renowned than war. New foes arise, threatening to bind our souls with secular chains. Help us to save free conscience from the paw of hireling wolves, whose gospel is their maw. And finally, in this section, the most probably difficult of the poems to tackle, it's a coded sonnet, a sonnet with two tales, consisting in each case of a half line and a couplet, sometimes used by people like the Italian Francesco Berni for comic effect. And this certainly is a comic poem, in that kind of savage beauty which Milton does so well in Paradise Lost, particularly of the fleeing of the children of Israel from Pharaoh. Jehovah, when in one night as he passed from Egypt marching, equaled with one stroke both her firstborn and all her bleating gods. That wonderful compression of the sort of the literal fact of the animal gods, and that metaphorical sense of bleating as ineffectual, superbly done by superb compression by this poet so often associated with long-windedness. Well, here is this rather difficult thing. On the new forces of conscience under the Long Parliament. Because you're thrown off your prelate lord, and with stiff vows renounced his liturgy to seize the widowed whore plurality from them whose sin ye envied, not abhorred. Dare ye for this adjure the civil sword to force our consciences that Christ set free, and ride us with a classic hierarchy, taught ye by Meir A.S. and Rutherford? Men whose life, learning, faith, and pure intent would have been held in high esteem with Paul must now be named and printed heretics by shallow Edwards and Scotch what do you call. But we do hope to find out all your tricks, your plots and packing worse than those of Trent, that so the Parliament may with their wholesome and preventive shears clip your phylacteries, though bulk your ears, and succor our just fears when they shall read this clearly in your charge. New presbyter is but old priest writ large. Again, that sort of wonderful play on semantics and orthography and the rest. That there is this connection between the presbyter and the priest, which completely cancels out, as Milton is saying, the false freedoms which are given to interpretation. And I will read now a poem from my Treatise of Civil Power. The title, which you will know, is the title of a Milton pamphlet. Geoffrey Hill to the Lord Protector Cromwell. This sequence is also in sonnet form. Cut our loss, make prognostics a backlist. For labor of petty conundrums, use any commonplace book as model. Strings of synonyms, cramped maxims, anecdotes 9/10 botched in conveyance. Turtle is first found in the protectorate, meaning of course the sea tortoise. Something having to do with English sailors. England went maritime and imperial, stared the world down, rousing her own ire. Keep to this strong voice, like Milton's sonnet with its single purpose. Your known affect for jury and for music, far-sighted blindness as a reach of vision, like Burford's levellers raked into their mounds, the Burford levellers raked into their mounds where members of Cromwell's own army who had tried to act upon various rights which they thought had been granted them by their victory, and Cromwell had them shot. Like Burford's levellers raked into their mounds. Second, Testudo is butler. I note your strength in shelled in that coarse-featured death mask. Even so, better than a boiled skull, the mock of Tyburn. How that exposed them, their French lisping, their 24 fiddlers, the new theatre, lascivious strolling and the royal whores. But why history? Nothing appeals to it except for murdered reporters. That's not history, a folk huddle more like, with marathons and talk shows, brief Diana. They made a film about you, that tough actor. Guinness outplayed him. as he finally outplayed himself. Then there's the other thing, Veronica Guerin's guilt-subliming wake. The tough actor is Richard Harris, who played Cromwell in the film of that name, in which Guinness was absolutely wonderful as Charles. Richard Harris sounded as though he had acute laryngitis. I thought this was just an accident of health, but I'm sure I saw elsewhere that he'd somehow deliberately acquired this laryngitis by shouting for an hour before every take, feeling, I think, that this probably sort of conveyed in some way the harshness of the man. Many, many years ago, in some published critical meditations on the work of Ezra Pound, I took up a powerful Shelley-like statement of Pound. All values ultimately come from our judicial sentences. And I objected to that. I said that poets are not legislators unless they happen to be so employed in government or law. I was trying to make sense of J.L. Austin at the time, and obviously conspicuously failing. Well, that was 36 years ago. And now I recognize how mean and impoverished my rebuke was. Where I failed to do justice to the matter was in overlooking a deeply embedded sense of the right, celebrated since at least Euripides in the Suppliant Women and the Areopagiticus of Isocrates, and found also in Tacitus, Petrarch, Milton, Blake, and Wordsworth, the right of the private citizen to dispute in public matters. Not merely that, but the proper status of the private citizen within the utterances of the public domain. George Norlin, writing of Isocrates in his Loeb edition of 1929, remarks that the Areopagiticus is cast in the form of an oration appropriate to be delivered before the General Assembly of Athens. And the fiction is consistently maintained throughout, although it was composed entirely for a reading public. We open the first page of Milton's Areopagitica, 1644, and find this: "They who to states and governors of the Commonwealth direct their speech, High Court of Parliament, or wanting such access, as lacking such access, in a private condition, write that which they foresee may advance the public good. I suppose them, as at the beginning of no mean endeavor, not a little altered and moved inwardly in their minds." Next, look at Wordsworth's tract of 1809. Let me give it its full title: Concerning the Relations of Great Britain, Spain, and Portugal to Each Other and to the Common Enemy, that is, the Napoleonic invaders of the peninsula, at this crisis, and specifically as affected by the Convention of Cintra. Turn to page 68 of the Oxford University Press text of 1915 of the Cintra tract, and we find Wordsworth writing, "Nor let it be blamed in any man, though his station be in private life, that upon this occasion he speaks publicly and gives a decisive opinion concerning that part of this public event and those measures which are more especially military. All have a right to speak and to make their voices heard as far as they have the power. I would claim that in the writing of this great tract, the implicit, as well as on several occasions, the explicit muse of Wordsworth is Milton. His language is, I think, derived from Milton. He uses the word zeal, as Milton does, not as Ben Jonson relishes it in Zeal of the Land Busy. And the word heat is Miltonic also. He takes metaphors and similes and tropes and general argument from Paradise Lost, as when he writes, with Napoleon in mind, the courage and enthusiasm have equally characterized the best and the worst beings, a Satan equally with an Abdiel. So spake the seraph Abdiel, faithful found. Among the faithless, faithful only he. Among innumerable faults, unmoved, unshaken, unseduced, unterrified. His loyalty he kept, his love, his zeal. Paradise Lost, Book 5, from the closing line. Wordsworth says, of course, that private persons have the right to speak on public matters as far as they have the power. Having this power is for the poet peculiarly the capacity to energize grammar, syntax, and rhythm in such a way as to distinguish, and here I employ Wordsworth's Sintra again, to distinguish strongholds in the imagination and a language and a ceremony of imagination from, on the other hand, blind energy, habits of daring found in men who, checked by no restraint of morality, suffer their evil passions to gain extraordinary strength in extraordinary circumstances. I implied at the start of these proceedings that the prevailing muse of poetry was and is history. Let me try a closer definition. For history, read energeia, which Philip Sidney defined as forcefulness. The ceremony of imagination is a form of energeia, but so is the anarchic power that Milton characterized by his trope, blind mouths. Throughout, I use the word muse as a convention. In the abstract, so to speak, there are no muses. They don't exist. It is the poet's forcefulness and necessity that decrees what his or her particular muse shall be. For Milton, as for a tradition out of which he developed, the elected muse was that of the just city. Behold, this is from Areopagitica, behold now this vast city, a city of refuge, the mansion house of liberty encompassed and surrounded with God's protection. The shop of war hath not there more anvils and hammers waking to fashion out the plates and instruments of armed justice in defense of beleaguered truth. Of course, it's in the idioms of 17th century Protestant English to insist that one could be encompassed and surrounded by spiritual and secular perils also. And it's one of the strengths of this period of English spiritual polemics that the attainment of regenerate energeia and the subjugation of unregenerate blind motion can never be entirely separated out. The final outcome depends on a capacity in the writer that is simultaneously technical and visionary. As Wordsworth writes again in Sintra, Lisbon and Portugal as city and soil were chiefly prized by us as a language. But our generals mistook the counters of the game for the stake played for. And again, in words that pertain most closely in this talk and this reading to the tenets to which I hold, the mind's own judgment upon its own act. It's according to the general sense of all my preceding remarks that I must be understood when I say that Milton's major muse in Areopagitica is the city and the language of the city. This makes me sound like Charles Williams, but I can live with that. In particular, his twin muses are Isocrates, author of the Areopagiticus, and Euripides, from whose The Suppliant Women he quotes on the book's title page in an English translation, presumably by himself. This is true liberty, when freeborn men, having to advise the public, may speak free, which he who can and will deserves high praise, who neither can nor will may hold his peace. What can be juster in a state than this? These lines in Euripides' play, they are lines 436 to 41, are spoken by Theseus. And you will say rightly that Theseus in Euripides is not a private man, as Milton knows himself to be in Areopagitica, or as Wordsworth knows himself to be throughout the Sintra treatise. The point to be made and proven in both these English tractates is that he who can distinguish blind energy from energeia and lay the distinction eloquently before the civic rulers of the Areopagus is indeed a Theseus. The fact that within the space of some 60 minutes I've chosen to pursue the topic I have precludes my giving any time to two other major aspects of Milton as muse. The first in my own order of priorities concerns the tradition out of which Milton may have developed his own political poetics. These, I would say, go back through Machiavelli to Petrarch. It's easy to forget that the concluding words of Il Principe are the words of Petrarch from the 16th canzone, Italia Mia, poem 128 in Derling's 1976 edition of the Rime Sparse. Machiavelli quotes four lines which in Derling's English read, manhood shall take up arms against rage, and the fighting shall be short, for ancient valor is not yet dead in Italic hearts. Manhood is the word Derling uses to translate Petrarch's vertu. But vertu can mean other things in Renaissance Italian argument. Skinner and Price say that it can signify ability, skill, energy, determination, strength, spiritedness, courage, prowess. And this, very interestingly, archers may be skilled in handling the virtu of their bows. If the latter sense holds, then one connotation of the Machiavellian virtu would correspond to what Milton, in a most favorable sense, describes as the acutest and the pertest operations of wit and subtlety, and to what Wordsworth terms the rapid insight of peculiar genius. The peculiar problem with Machiavellian virtu is that while in the main it is a value word suggesting wit and subtlety applied to good, it may also indicate a courage or strength of malign energy. In so deploying the term, Machiavelli helped create the richest of semantic legacies for a poet and prose writer such as Milton to work with. Without it, I think we would not have such savage poignancies as Milton's, and princely counsel in his face yet shone, majestic though in ruin. That's in the second book of Paradise Lost and refers to Beelzebub. It's not meant, of course, to be read sentimentally, but to be understood as a given. As a poet myself, I am involved for hours a day with questions of efficacy. But the effective may be malign, though even then in a different quality or degree to the ineffective. An Italian poet of the 20th century whom I greatly admire is the late Eugenio Montale. Nonetheless, I vehemently dispute one article in his poetic credo. Montale sees, I think in a trope too much clung to by subsequent lesser poets, he sees the poem as a message cast adrift in a bottle. I say it is not a message cast adrift in a bottle. Nor, of course, does he, really. And I would like to read a translation by myself of Montale's poem La Bufera, The Storm. In the original, it's prefaced by a quatrain from the 16th century French Protestant Agrippa d'Aubigné to the effect that we are in the hands of the princes who persecute us. The storm that batters the magnolia's impermeable leaves, the long-drawn drum roll of Martian thunder with its hail, crystal acoustics trembling in your night's lair disturb you, while the gold transfumed from the mahoganies, the pages' rims of deluxe books, still burns a sugar grain under your eyelid shell. Lightning that makes stark white the trees, the walls, suspending them, interminable instant, marbled manner and cataclysm, deep in you sculpted, born now as condemnation. This binds you closer to me, strange sister, than any love. So the harsh buskings, bashing of castanets and tambourines around the spoiler's ditch, Fandango's foot wrap, and over all some gestures still to be defined, as when you turned away and casting with a hand that cloudy mass of hair from off your forehead, gave me a sign and stepped into the dark. Milton also profoundly affected the creative thinking of Gerard Hopkins, who wrote in 1878 to the minor poet Canon Dixon, "I quite agree with what you write about Milton. His verse, as one reads it, seems something necessary and eternal." And he adds, "So to me does Purcell's music." I should like to think that it was Hopkins's involvement with Milton, in a manner at once deeply exploratory, inchoate even, and highly articulate, that lies behind what I consider to be one of the most essential instincts concerning poetry to have emerged in the past 150 years. It can be found in a letter to Robert Bridges, dated November the 4th, 1882. A letter in which Hopkins brings together the two words monumentality and bidding, and argues that bidding is the art or virtue of saying everything right to or at the hearer, and of discarding everything that does not bid, does not tell. It is most difficult to combine this bidding, such a fugitive thing, with a monumental style, but it can be done. Witness Greek plays and Shakespeare. I would add to Hopkins's list, I would add Milton and the Prelude and Hopkins's own best work as combining successfully monumentality and bidding. I think it's true of Hopkins' greatest poem that nature is a Heraclitean fire and of the comfort of the resurrection. A poem which is at once all monumentality and all bidding. Cloud puffball, torn tufts, tossed billows flaunt forth, then Chevy on an air-built thoroughfare. Heaven roisterers in gay gangs, they throng. They glitter in marches, down rough cast, down dazzling whitewash. Wherever an elm arches, shive lights and shadow tackle, in long lashes, lace, lance, and pear. Delightfully the bright wind boisterous ropes, wrestles, beats earth bare of yester tempest's creases. In pool and rut peel parches, squandering ooze to squeezed dough, crust, dust, stanches, starches, squadroned masks and man marks. Treadmire toil there, foot fretted in it, million fueled, nature's bonfire burns on. But quench her bonniest, dearest to her, her clearest self, its spark, man. How fast his fired in it, his mark on mine. Is gone. Both are in an unfathomable. All is in an enormous dark, drowned. Oh, pity and indignation. Man-shape that shone sheer off disseveral a star, death blots black out. No mark is any of him at all so stark, but vastness blurs and time beats level. Enough! The resurrection, the heart's clarion. Away grief's gasping, joyless days, dejection. Across my foundering deck shone a beacon, an eternal beam. Flesh fade and mortal trash fall to the residuary worm. world's wildfire leave but ash. In a flash, at a trumpet crash, I am all at once what Christ is, since he was what I am. And this Jack joke, poor potsherd, patch, matchwood, immortal diamond, is immortal diamond. Thank you.
Yes, all right. I don't know, I've only got one ear, I don't know where sound is coming from.
Thank you. Our distinguished speaker has agreed to answer or comment on a few questions. This is unusual, and if it had just been readings, I don't think that would have been open to us, but... Geoffrey Hill has kindly agreed to accept a few questions following his talk. So I look open to the audience.
May I suggest that the issue of energy, blind energy, and monumentality raises questions about architectonics. Yeah. Perhaps even in the sonnets, we can sense that this poet, Milton, is far happier in Paradise Lost than he is in shorter forms. When I hear you extol nature as a Heraclitian fire, as Gerald Manley Hopkins' supreme achievement, I feel I must object that the resurrection is held back like an ace of trumps to settle the sheer force, the Turner-esque apocalyptic force that we've got earlier in the poem. And that, as with Hugo Wolf, almost obsessed with the music of Wagner, with Hopkins obsessed, I feel, with Milton, we have a very real problem of architectonics that leaves us with Hopkins being a rather exasperatingly major and minor poet. You read from a letter in which Milton was bracketed with Purcell. I'm afraid, as far as I'm concerned, I can see very little heat or kinship between the geniuses of those two men. I hope that answers the question.
Well, I think you're wrong about the sudden eruption of Enough the Resurrection, three lines from the end of the Heraclitean Fire poem, because it must be abrupt. There is no natural connection between mortality and immortality. It can only be introduced as a radical break with the natural declensions of human and natural life. So I disagree with you about that. I think that in Purcell's music, as in the Lament of Dido, the end of the small opera, I think you have a magnificent instance of monumentality and bidding coinciding, because the technicalities of the music are built, I believe, on a kind of chaconne or passacaglia, which is a particular way of sort of repeating certain basic melodic lines. But Purcell has a genius for counterpointing the emotional emphasis of the singing voice against the formal restrictions of the music. I think of another instance by him, the Blessed Virgin's expostulation.
which in fact, if you look at the text, is a very neat verse of couplets by Naumpage. And what Purcell does is to musically anticipate sprung rhythm, because he completely breaks down and remakes Naumpage's neat trim emphases into a series of sort of wild cries. I call. That's not in Tate. That's a word from Tate, but that particular kind of sprung rhythm emphasis is all personal. And I think that Hopkins's poem to Purcell is embodying that kind of recognition, that kind of acknowledgement. I very much like Hopkins' riposte to somebody who'd sent in a letter of objection. I should indicate that of course you are not first in objecting to what Hopkins was doing. Robert Bridges, a very tame poet, although a loyal friend, also objected to what Hopkins was doing. And I like the response that Hopkins made in a letter to an objector. What does my poem on Henry Purcell mean? It means that Purcell's music is none of your damned subjective rot. And if I loved him for nothing else, I would love him for that. Because one of the necessary consequences of plutocratic anarchy is that it causes inevitably a diminishment of anything but sort of floating subjective rot ideas. And what I've tried to indicate in my talk on Milton as Muse is this. You brought the word in yourself, architectonics. You see, I would accept the phrase, I would accept your word, architectonics. But I think I would probably dispute virtually every inference you have drawn from this term. I'm not offering to dispute it with you. But I would.
Let's see.
I have to say, thank you for that answer. I am myself a poet, but emphatically not a tame one.
And so, there's a dare here. Who would dare to ask another question? I hope we have one. Can you speak more loud?
Yes, I'm rather deaf.
Your list of people with a monumental style, I don't think you mentioned Blake. Was there a reason?
I did refer in passing to Blake. I said that given the things I wanted to concentrate on, it was with great sorrow that I realized I would not, within the compass of 55 minutes, be able to say a great call. Of course, Blake. I mean, after all, who wrote a poem in two books called Milton? What I think I said in the sort of two or three sentences I felt able to devote was that it was the collision of Milton and Blake. It is a kind of collision, because Blake both hated Milton for his theology and loved him for other aspects. I mean, what you have in the collision between Blake and Milton is the collision between energies. Energies in opposition. It isn't, I don't think one should say, well, I'm siding with Milton or I'm siding with Blake. One should say that the collision between the genius of Milton and the genius of Blake is one of the most marvelous, energizing factors in the history of poetry in English, you know, of the last 250 years. So I agree, my treatment was inadequate, but if I had tried to deal with it adequately, it would have required a course of lectures, you know. Which, of course, I'm perfectly willing to do. For a small fee.
We may take you up on that in the future. But I think for this evening, I think we should let you rest. We have been fortunate indeed. We asked only that Geoffrey Hill read from Milton and from his own work, and he has done so much more. It has... for my ear, at least, been telegraphic in part, but we will have the podcast, and so we will be able to listen to this again several times, I think, for many of us, from the college webpage, and that'll be there in a couple of days. And we have one more Lady Margaret lecture on Milton this Milton year, and that will be given by Christopher Ricks. Information on that, too, is on the college webpage. But for now, can I ask you to join me in thanking our speaker for his powerful presentation.